Programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by
The Schoen Group, located in beautiful downtown Sonoma. The Schoen Group is affiliated with Sotheby's International Realty. Our goal is to be your realtor, consultants, and representative for many generations to come. For information and guidance regarding Wine Country Real Estate, you may contact us at 707-933-1515 or visit schoengroup.com. Entertainment is blooming across Sonoma Valley, and the calendar is filling up fast. From live music and wine tasting to community gatherings, art shows, festivals, and nightlife, there's something happening almost every day and night of the week once the Tuesday night market season kicks into gear. KSVY and Sonoma TV have been hard at work updating the community calendar at SonomaValleyEvents.com to help you discover what's happening around the valley. Need inspiration for your next night out? Looking for live music, local culture, or family-friendly fun? Visit ksvy.org and click Sonoma Valley Events on our website header and let the good times roll.
The following show is brought to you in part by
Highway 12 Winery. Sonoma wines ranging from Sauvignon Blancs and Chardonnays to local reds such as the Mission Hardware Old Sonoma Red, with a tasting room located at 27 East Napa Street, Suite S. Hours, 11 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. daily. More information, 707-938-8815 or at highway12winery.com.
The Red Grape, located at 529 1st Street West, across from the Plaza in Sonoma. The Red Grape features New Haven-style pizza with thin, crispy crust high-fired in a stone-lined pizza ovens. For more information, call them at 707-996-4103. Visit their website at theredgrape.com or find them on Facebook at The Red Grape.
Unicom Tax Services, located at 755 Broadway. For more information, you can call 707-343-1898 or you can visit their website at unicomtax.com.
The Sonoma Valley Visitors Bureau, the only spot to get a regional parks pass in the valley, reminding you to support local restaurants by ordering direct and picking up your food in person. For more information, visit sonomavalley.com or call 707-996-1090.
Sebastiani Theater, located on the Sonoma Plaza. The theater offers a year-round schedule of films, live music, comedy, magic, and theatrical performances. It is also available to rent for private events with seating for up to 320 guests. More at SebastianiTheater.com.
Here comes the sun, and I say it's all right.
Good morning, Sonoma. It's the morning show on Mondays. And it is Monday. It's Monday, the 29th of June. Is everybody up, roaring, ready to go? Hard not to be, given how early the sun rises these days and how long it stays with us. I'm Marcia Maycumber, your host here for the next couple of hours. And, oh, we have a humdinger of a show for you today. Pages, passion, all kinds of stuff from the authors that we have on the show today. Yeah, we're leaning hard into summer reading. We have a lot of guests to talk about that today, including Stephen Pressfield, Beth Simone Novick, Thomas S. Mullaney, Anna Manwaring, and Stephen Kotler. All will be here this morning to talk about their latest books, because there are so many out right now. And with so much information. So let's dig into it. Before our first guest arrives, let's talk a little bit about what happens on June 29th as in it's National Camera Day, it's National Waffle Iron Day, International Mud Day, National Almond Butter Crunch Day, National Tropic Day, National Hug Holiday, National Parchment Day for those working on those pages, and International Day of the Tropics. Oh, and last but not least, National Handshake Day. So, all things that you can take a look at. See which one of those appeals to you. I imagine for many, National Waffle Iron Day sounds the most appealing to a lot of people. But maybe it's the National Camera Day that is the most fun for you. I bet you you're going to let us know as time goes on, as it were. In any event, how about in the past? What has happened on June the 29th in the past? Well, if we wind it way back, Raymond of Poitiers was killed in the Battle of Hénin during the Second Crusade. And when was that, you might say? Are you scratching your head? Are you working hard to extract this information from your cranium? The year was 1149 A.D. Raymond of Poitiers killed at the Battle of Hénin. Let's jump forward just a little bit. On this date in 1312, Henry VII was crowned the Holy Roman Emperor in Rome by papal authority. So that was Henry VII. If we jump forward even further to a sad day in English history, at least I think of it this way. On this date in 1613, the original Globe Theatre in London burned down during a performance of Henry VIII. Oh, that, you know, lighting the stage by candle and all that could be very problematic. So, not so good. 20 years later on this date, another major, major, major event took place. Galileo Galilei was formally tried by the Roman Inquisition in relation to heliocentrism charges. On this date in 1633, heliocentrism, you know, at that time, they were pretty darn certain that the Earth was at the center of everything and not the sun. It's a big deal. Let's jump forward a little bit. Oh, you might have been familiar with this if you've been catching up on your Revolutionary War history recently or heard about it on some documentary. On this date in 1767, Parliament, as in the British Parliament, passed the Townshend Acts, imposing more taxes on the American colonies because they were just darn determined that we needed to pay our share, or so they thought, to help pay off the debt they had incurred during the British and Indian Wars, or French and Indian Wars. They were just really quite unhappy about all of that, so that was the next thing they tried. It was only like a year later that they were repealed, or two, for being wholly ineffective and everybody hated them. Now, if we want to jump forward just a little bit more, smack dab in the middle of our revolutionary history, on this date in 1776, Virginia adopted its first state constitution, establishing independent governance during the American Revolution. So, Virginia jumped right in there, and that constitution was written by, ding, 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 you should know by now, Thomas Jefferson. He got a lot of things written in a short amount of time back during our revolutionary history. All right. Let's jump forward a little bit here. 1848. Let's see. this was the beginning of the June Days uprising in Paris. And the French government worked very hard to suppress the uprising. Because the workers revolting en masse, as it were, hence the uprising, over bad working conditions. They were unhappy about that. On this date in 1855, another, you know, kind of infamous day in history, the Kansas-Nebraska Act became a central catalyst for violent conflict in Bleeding Kansas. with more territorial political escalation taking place during this period. A lot of flack over that because some people wanted Kansans to be allowed to continue slavery, and others were like, this has to go. So it was a big deal. 1855. On this date. In 1863, on this date, the Battle of Gettysburg really was getting towards its full engagement. hopefully, you know that the Union and Confederate forces were getting going with their opening maneuvers about this time. And it was right about July 2nd and July 4th. They were at their peak. In 1863, before things came to a head. All right, let's jump forward a little bit. Who else has our attention? How about France? On this date in 1880, formally annexed Tahiti and its surrounding islands in French Polynesia. And if we jump forward a little bit further, like about 30 plus years, on this date, 1913, the Second Balkan War began as Bulgaria attacked its former allies, Serbia and Greece. Not the most pleasant experience. And what really tipped the scales on the other way? Well, you know what happens, but here's the hint. On this date, 1914, Archduke Ferdinand, Franz Ferdinand, and Sophie arrived in Sarajevo on the eve of the assassination events. They didn't know they were coming, obviously. But they arrived in the area in Sarajevo in 1914 before things went a little sideways, as it were. On this date, 1927, jumping forward to really something fun and pleasant, Babe Ruth hit his 29th home run of the season in Major League Baseball. It was a historically related event. Let's see if I can get my page to turn here. Here we go. Let's jump forward. On this date, 1945, the Soviet Union annexed the Carpathian Ruthenia region from Czechoslovakia. 1945. They were just going to lay their hands on whatever they could. In 1956, on this date, the U.S. Federal Aid Highway Act was signed into law by Dwight Eisenhower, initiating the U.S. interstate highway system. A good thing, I think, for all of us, don't you? I hope so. I thought the U.S. highway system is a good thing. In 1974, Isabel Perón became the president of Argentina following Juan Perón's death after many, 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 many years. In 1987, the Iran-Contra affair began developing. As the U.S. congressional investigations expanded. In 1995, on this date, the Space Shuttle Atlantis completed its STS-71 mission, the first shuttle docking with the Russian space station Mir took place. On this date in 2007, Apple released the first iPhone in the U.S. So there you go. In 2009, the Beijing subway expansion opened major transit lines ahead of more urban infrastructure upgrades. In 2012, the European Union approved Cyprus's bailout negotiations and sovereign debt crisis escalation, thus easing some of the fears that were going on in Cyprus, where things had gone sideways in a big, big way. In a big, big way. Let's see. NASA's New Horizons spacecraft was on final approach for a Pluto flyby sequence on this date in 2015. So NASA was busy, 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 busy. a good thing, I would hope. I would hope. So anyway, I am trying to get certain things here. Ah, the joys of doing all this ourselves, right? Okay, sorry about that. Bored and everything. Sent one. Antoine Saint-Exupéry was born on this date in 1900. You're going, who? Antoine Saint-Exupéry? You know, the Little Prince, the author of The Little Prince. Good guy. Slim Pickens, born in the state in 1919. Wonderful actor. Giorgio Napolitano was born in the state in 1925. He was an Italian president. Gary Busey, born in the state in 1944. Actor Sharon Lawrence in 1961. Richard Lewis in 1947. Chris O'Donnell, 1970. These are not in order. All right, bunches of others. You know what? Because that got out of order, I think it's a good time for me to give you a tune. How about that? A tune would be good. Here we go. You're going to know this from Bill Withers, Grover Washington Jr., just the two of us, everybody.
Drops fall, and the beauty of it all is when the sun comes shining through to make those rainbows in my mind. When I think of you sometime, and I want to spend some time with you, just the two of us. We can make it if we try, just the two of us. We look for love, no time for tears. Wasted water's all that is, and it don't make no flowers grow. Good things might come to those who wait, but not for those who wait too late. We gotta go for all we know. Just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Just the two of us.
Or at highway12winery.com.
The Red Grape, located at 529 First Street West, across from the Plaza in Sonoma.
The Sonoma Valley Visitors Bureau. For more information, visit sonomavalley.com or call 707-996-1090.
Sebastiani Theater on the Sonoma Plaza, offering live shows and event rentals. More at sebastianitheater.com.
Climate change is bad. Is there something simple I can do to help fight it?
Yes, there are many things you can do, but a very simple action is to properly sort your waste.
What do you mean by proper sorting?
Proper sorting means to separate your waste at home and place it into the correct cart. This means to put food waste and organics into the green cart, put recyclables into the blue cart, and put the rest into the black, gray trash cart for the landfill.
How does this combat climate change?
By properly sorting food waste, you keep it out of the landfill. Food waste in landfills creates methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. Instead, the green cart materials go to a compost facility to create compost, which helps to retain moisture in soil and is filled with rich nutrients that are beneficial for growing healthy plants. By properly sorting recyclables, we can recover and reuse valuable materials, which reduces the need to harvest new raw materials, prevents pollution, saves energy, and reduces greenhouse gas emissions.
Wow, you're right. I can make a difference and help combat climate change.
To learn more about what you can do to combat climate change, go to www.sonomacity.org/sustainability.
Please, sort it, Sonoma!
And now back to The Morning Show.
Gonged back in, everybody. We are back at 8:20.
You've been listening to The Morning Show.
We still are listening to The Morning Show. But we will let that go. I'm Marcia Meekumber, your host here until 10 o'clock this morning. And we are kicking things off with our first guest this morning. Stephen Pressfield is the best-selling author of The War of Art, Gates on Fire, The Legend of Bagger Vance, and a long list of novels that blend history, adventure, big questions about what it means to be human, all those good things. And his brand new novel is The Arcadian. It follows a warrior named Telamon, a man cursed to live and die over and over and over again across centuries. He's searching for redemption. It is partly historical epic, partially spiritual quest, part Western on horseback. Stephen, welcome to The Morning Show in Sonoma. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Marcia. It's great to be in Sonoma.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So this is really, you know, a bit of an epic quest here. You've written about warriors for decades and decades. And this time you gave your hero something that's kind of harder to fight than an enemy army, and I'm saying a curse. Your protagonist here is having to fight a curse. When did you kind of realize that Telamon's real battle wasn't really going to be against other people, but it's kind of against himself?
This is kind of a weird answer to that, Marcia, but
that's okay.
Sometimes characters in fiction sort of appear on the page and they have a life of their own, you know, and you can't stop them. And so Telamon appeared actually in two books back in the early 2000s of mine, where in different centuries where he hadn't aged a day. And I thought, well, I wonder, that's a little weird. And so I wrote another book called The Man at Arms. It was entirely about him to sort of explore this. And in any event, I came to the conclusion that he had been committed some crime in the deep past as a soldier, as a warrior, and that he had been cursed by heaven to live lifetime after lifetime, always as a soldier. And that led to this newest one, The Arcadian, where he begins to think maybe this is his last lifetime and he can finally kind of get off the wheel of karma that has been plaguing him. So anyway, that's the short version of this.
It's hard to imagine what is going through the head, you know, and you obviously did this as a writer of somebody, you know, what if we kept coming back and we knew we were going to keep coming back? You know, how would we think and behave differently and all those things? It's really fascinating. And one of the things that stayed with me was a horse that follows a man across 1500 years. Do you remember, like, when it came to you that the horse was coming along for this journey as well?
Well, the gist of the what we would call the inciting incident of this story is it takes place in around 1500 AD in Spain, right after the discovery of the New World. Anyway, Telamon is fighting some nameless thing as a mercenary, and he notices this horse kind of following his outfit and keeping at a distance, never letting anybody get close. And the horse has the brand of an X on the side of it, and Telamon recognizes it as his horse from 1500 years ago when he served in the 10th Legion of Rome. That's what the X is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that 10th Legion is the Rome that is the legion that burned Jerusalem in 70 AD, a great crime.
Yes.
And so so Telamon, when he sees this horse, he says, what? How does this horse arrive out of nowhere? Could this possibly be a sign from heaven that maybe this horse is going to lead me out of this wheel of karma, which it turns out to be true. So
he's paying attention.
That's how the story starts.
Pretty fascinating. So one thing that's intriguing is Telamon has done some pretty horrible things in his lives, not just in his life. Yet, you know, as a reader, we're rooting for him, you know. What is it about the flawed character seeking redemption that keeps pulling us in as readers? That's really kind of an art and a science for professional writers such as yourself to make possible for us still to root for somebody with such great flaws.
That's a great question, Marcia. And I think we can identify with it ourselves. I mean, we're all flawed characters, and we all, in a way, I think, at least I do, feel like we're in need of redemption one way or another. You know, even a religion, if you just go back to the Garden of Eden, right? When God casts Adam and Eve out, he places a curse on them, you know? Henceforth shalt thou eat thy bread in the sweat of thy face. Thorns and thistles I shall set before you, for dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return. And, you know, the whole doctrine of original sin tells us we're born, you know, with having done something wrong, right? And we're in need of redemption. So I think we can all kind of relate to that and root for a character, you know, even if he's flawed and even if he has done bad things, because we've all, you know, we're all imperfect, and we can all relate to that.
Yeah.
That's my theory anyway.
Okay. Well, you should stand by that theory, because you get to hold on it as the writer. You write a lot about combat. Your books are often, though, about people's internal battles. You know, we talk about the redemption and all that. Do you see the parallel? You know, there's combat campaigns, and there's internal combat going on. Do you see life as a kind of campaign to be fought?
Absolutely. I do. I see life as a okay. battle. You know, you referred a little earlier to my book, The War of Art.
Yes.
Which is a book aimed at writers and creative people about the war inside our heads, the war against our own self-sabotage, procrastination, perfectionism, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how many people know that they have a book in them or a movie or something in them, but for one reason or another, they never get around to doing it? They get defeated by this kind of demon in their head. So I do believe that we are fighting a battle inside our head. And then to write war stories is really just a way of turning it into a metaphor and making the enemy actually real.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So there's a through line in this novel that asks if people, you know, if humans can really pay for their mistakes, can they do it? Was that kind of like a question that you were sitting at the beginning of writing the book, going, can we ever pay for our mistakes? Is it possible?
That's another great question, Marcia. I got to give you credit here. You're asking some great questions. But absolutely, that really is the question that the novel asks. Is there justice built into the fabric of life? And I don't just mean justice like courts of law or something like that, but kind of the idea of karma, that if we do something, harm another person, we pay for it. Maybe not in this life, but in the next life.
Right.
And I'm definitely a believer that we have multiple lives.
Yeah. Well, certainly Telamon is facing this over and over again, and that thought's very conscious.
Yeah, there's a great line in the movie Gladiator where Maximus says something like, I will have my revenge in this life or the next.
That's right.
So,
it landed when it was spoken. Most definitely.
Yeah.
You're right. You're right. You've said that every novel begins with a what if. What was the moment that the what if behind the Arcadian became powerful enough that you couldn't ignore it anymore?
Another great question. I found a quote from the Greek philosopher Empedocles 40 years ago, and I kept it all this time because I knew there was a story in this quote. And the quote basically says, anyone who takes another life, kills a person, I'll quote now, 3 times 10,000 years that soul shall wander, an outcast from felicity, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was sort of the what if for me. I thought, what if that's true? What if, you know, a soldier, let's say in war, even fighting a legitimate fight, you know, kills the enemy. Does that mean he's going to be cursed for 30,000 years? Could that, or even if we boil it down to something a little shorter, is there justice in the universe? And that's a great what if premise. So that sort of was the whole premise of this story, yes, to just take it as if that were true and then follow from there.
Yes. And you have to wonder if today's soldiers, you know, this crosses their minds as well, whatever they're doing, wherever they're fighting a war. Let's just, you know, for right now, let's just say between Ukraine and Russia, on both sides, you know, are those soldiers thinking about it? And it's a question we can't really answer ourselves, but does make you wonder. Telemann's lived many, many lives. He's still carrying the weight, though, of the choices he made centuries and centuries earlier. Why do you think we're so fascinated by the idea that the past never lets go of us?
That's another great question. I mean, if you look at like ancient Greek drama, that was all about it from one generation to the next. You know, a curse or a revenge passes on. And I do think, you know, that's the way we live our lives in some way. You know, it's like a crime is committed, whether it can be even a smallish thing, and it has to be paid for in one way or another. It has to be expiated in some way or another, but we feel like we haven't served our time. So this story with Telemann is kind of like he gets to this one lifetime and he thinks, have I served my time? Is my sentence up? Am I now about to be released? Which is another question that the book kind of asks. If that happens, when do we know that we're off the wheel of karma? So anyway, a lot of deep questions in there.
Yeah. And, you know, as you speak of this, it makes me think of the scenes in Patton with George C. Scott and Carl Malden. And what actually comes to mind is I think they were standing in some Roman ruins and you hear that trumpet echo that goes, and they're talking about reincarnation and coming back, and George C. Scott as Patton is talking about coming back as, you know, he was certain he was a Roman soldier before. It's got a little bit of that echo to it. You went to Spain to research the book for part of it. Tell us a little bit about, you know, if there was a particular place, a landscape you saw, a historical detail that really brought it all home for you.
There is a place called Montilla, Montilla, which was the home of a great warrior known as El Gran Capitan. And that somehow, I had read this gentleman's autobiography or biography, and I thought this is that sort of gave me the whole sense of the place, and I wanted to go there. And the interesting thing about a lot of those areas in Spain, they're kind of big, wide valleys that you can look across, you know, 10 miles to the other side of the valley. And around the rim of the valley, there'll be like maybe 8 forts, and they're all in communication with each other by fire and messenger. And that was kind of how certain areas were protected. And I thought, when I saw that, I said, I got to really incorporate this into the story. So the whole point of going there was just to sort of feel the landscape and get a sense of what it was like.
Right.
And That scene in Patton, I love people I've talked to, I know, love that scene.
Yeah.
You know, where, if I remember right, he says he's driving along with some of his subordinates and they're looking for a particular, the scene of a current battle with Rommel. And he says, no, the battlefield was over here.
Yes.
And, he makes them drive there and they think, oh, he's crazy. The guy's lost his mind. And then he says, the Carthaginians entered by that gap. And the Romans were waiting for da 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 da. And he really did. Patton really did believe in previous lives.
Yeah, I think
I believe in it too.
Yeah, and I think he said something. I was here.
I was here. That's how he knew.
Yeah, it was really kind of a stunning piece of detail and all that. And it also made me think. You were quoting Epistocles or something?
Empedocles.
And I was trying to remember. And I don't know if you just saw the news that came out last week about them finding some lost plays and poems, and I think by him, in the scrolls that were at Pompeii, you know, which they have managed to decipher. They can't unroll them because, of course, they were buried under all the ash and burned. Uh-huh. But through modern scanning techniques, they've been able to digitally unroll the scrolls.
Wow. Wow.
And I thought he was one of the ones who was mentioned. Anyway.
I hadn't heard that at all. Wow.
Yeah, it was one of those things that blipped by in the news last week. So one of the surprises in the novel is that a hardened warrior ends up being connected to a very vulnerable young girl. What does that relation, why does that relationship remain such an important element in your storytelling there?
I think a lot of times if you have as sort of a gunslinger type character, you know, kind of a hyper male man of violence, if you're only telling his story, it's not that interesting. What really makes it interesting, and if you think about Westerns, they almost always involve like a Clint Eastwood type of character with a vulnerable character that might be a young boy like in Shane.
Yes.
Or it could be the prostitutes in Unforgiven.
Yeah.
That the Clint Eastwood character. So there's a girl in this, and actually she appeared earlier in the preceding book, A Man at Arms, in a whole different century, and is now back again. And they recognize each other across the centuries.
Wow.
So I think it's that sort of character that kind of humanizes the ultra male man of violence type of thing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Readers really know you for your historical fiction, but this novel kind of wanders into spiritual territory, metaphysical territory. Did it feel different in writing it from some of your more traditional stories?
It did, definitely. And I think as I get older, I'm getting more and more into those questions, you know, of mortality and stuff like that.
Yes.
And so I sort of wonder, as this book comes out, if the readers that like me from before are going to follow me into this area. So far, they have. I've gotten a lot of good feedback.
Good.
So, which is good because I've just finished the next book and it goes even farther into that.
Okay,
concept.
That's exciting. That means in a year or two, I can have you back on the show and we can talk about the next one. So I'm curious. So taking a step back and looking across all of your books, what have the warriors taught you about courage? Is this something that the rest of us can learn to use in ordinary life?
I mean, I think we have to, but I would say that the core of courage, oddly enough to me, is love, and is selflessness. And I think that the more, if you think about heroes that win the Congressional Medal of Honor, it's because they sacrificed their life for their brothers and sisters in combat. So so I think the more we can connect to our own love for other people, for our brothers and sisters, the more, the easier it'll be to do the right thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. We've been talking with Stephen Pressfield. He is the author of numerous books, but the brand new one that is out at booksellers now is The Arcadian, available with booksellers everywhere. Stephen, thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marcia. I hope I can come back with the next one.
Yes, looking All forward right. to it. Thank you, Stephen.
And best to everybody in Sonoma. Thanks a
thank
lot.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Bye-bye. All right, listeners, let's take a quick little break before we come back with Beth Simone Novick right after this.
You've been listening to The Morning Show, sponsored by
Highway 12 Winery. More information, 707-938-8815. Or at highway12winery.com.
The Red Grape, located at 529 First Street West, across from the Plaza in Sonoma.
The Sonoma Valley Visitors Bureau. For more information, visit sonomavalley.com or call 707-996-1090.
Sebastiani Theater on the Sonoma Plaza, offering live shows and event rentals. More at sebastianitheater.com.
This health moment is brought to you in part by Sonoma Valley Hospital.
One recent medical study concluded that our lifestyle choices contribute more to our state of health than do hereditary factors. In fact, lifestyle choices are the major factor in determining most people's health. This is a reminder that the decisions we make every day about diet, exercise, coping with stress, and even our communications with others have a powerful influence on our health and well-being. Let's remember to be self-aware and make good practices and healthy habits.
If you have questions or need help with CalFresh, Medi-Cal, or CashFresh aid benefits but have trouble getting to a county office, here's some good news. Opening Doors Mobile Services is now a new program bringing Sonoma County support closer to you. To find out when the Open Doors Mobile Services van is coming to your neighborhood, visit opendoorssc.com. That's opendoorssc.com or call 707-565-5800.
And now back to The Morning Show.
And we're back. It is The Morning Show, Monday morning, the 29th of June. I'm Marcia Maycumber, your host here until 10 o'clock this morning. We are pivoting to our next guest. Beth Simone Novick is author of the brand new book, Reboot, AI and the Race to Save Democracy. And boy, is it a race ever. In case you don't know Dr. Novick, she is one of the leading voices at the intersection of technology, government, and democracy. She is a professor at Northeastern University, founder of the Government Lab. She is a former U.S. Deputy Chief Technology Officer and former State Chief AI Strategist. Good morning, Beth. It's good to have you here on the show. Thank you for joining
us. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. So AI is very new for a lot of people, but it has been around for a few years. It's just gaining a lot of momentum, in particular in 2026. A lot of books that talk about AI start with AI, but you start with democracy, something that is on tenterhooks these days, it would seem. What made you realize the real story isn't about the AI stuff, but whether or not our institutions are capable of keeping up with it altogether?
Well, I've been working in the technology space for a very, very long time and started years ago already with the beginning of the World Wide Web when I created what was then the very first, I think I'll claim it, it's so long ago no one will remember, the very first platform for community deliberation and engagement. So I was I had been a student of history, was interested in the 1920s and 30s and what made some institutions stand strong in the face of fascism and Nazism and what made other institutions break and succumb to authoritarianism. So fast forward as a student of history, but then growing up in the age of the internet and the World Wide Web, was very interested in the ways in which we could use these new technologies to allow us to express ourselves, to engage in free speech, to have community conversations, to do some of the things that radio has always done for a long time, but whether we could expand those rights to more people. So the interest, the fundament was always about democracy and really asking about whether the technologies that we have today could help us do better. Alas, I think a lot of the hopes we had for the web were not realized. We have a lot of people talking, but we don't have anybody listening is the problem. And so the question that's at the center of the book is, can we do a better job?
Yeah, that is the challenge right there. And with many people feeling very frustrated by government, schools, public institutions, when you say that democracy is an, you know, is an information processing problem, what does that look like on an everyday basis?
I think you point out exactly the right examples. And look, people feel, if we say the word democracy, let's be fair, it's a sort of very ambiguous word. It means a lot of different things to different people. To one person, it means, that's my right to go vote and elect the people who will represent me. That's what most people think of, I would say, when you say democracy. For other people, it's about something much more local. It's like what happens in my school or in my workplace, my ability to some self-determination, to some voice over what happens in my own community. For other people, it's about just having that functioning government. You know, once I elect those people, I would like them to take out the trash. I would like them to provide healthcare, reduce traffic, reduce the price of eggs is on a lot of people's minds and such things.
And gas.
There are really, yes, and gas. And there are, as you said before, we're on tenterhooks really worrying about, partly for very good reason and partly because there is a bit of a manufactured sense of crisis and outrage, that we're in trouble. So I think the day-to-day for most people is really about that question of, can I get the government benefit to which I'm entitled? When I go to the DMV, am I waiting online for an hour? When I go to the ER, if I have a public hospital, let's say, am I waiting for 6 hours? You know, are we backsliding into a place where we are not functioning as well as we need to address, to be fair, the increasingly complex challenges of our time, from climate change to increased healthcare costs to decreasing life expectancy? There's a lot of challenges, and we have institutions that are frankly built for the 19th century.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot to chew off. And you have had an inside view of government. You have been in the thick of it. And I'm curious if there was a moment that you saw a problem of governance that could have been solved in weeks, but instead it took months and months or longer that or years, simply because the system couldn't absorb the information fast enough. I mean, that's a big issue.
Goodness, yeah. Well, So you're right to point out, and let me make very clear that even though there are these big themes about AI and democracy, this is a very, very practical book born out of very real-world lived experience in the federal government, in state government. I now work with all the states and many of the cities on their AI training. And have worked internationally in various governments. So a lot of this is about sort of boots on the ground, what I'm seeing, and the very real heroes who are doing things right. And I'll give you one quick example. I do mention this in the book, which is a program that my own team worked on. We fought to get $10 million from the legislature that we were going to give away to train people. It's a job training program. Details don't really matter so much. But here we are, we have the legislation, we have the money budgeted. We had the money. That's always the problem. We don't have the money. We had the money. We could not give it away. We could not give free money away to people because there were issues like, okay, who is the vendor who's going to provide the debit card? Who is the vendor who will provide the training? Are those the same vendor? We have to compete that. We have to do a procurement. There were then all kinds of rules because this was going to be a new kind of program that would not just provide job training, but things like bus fare, elder care, child care, the thing you need to be able to afford to go to school to take a course. And because that didn't fit within the rules, anyway, took 4 years for us to give away free money. That's the kind of thing that
logistics
should not be happening. Ugh. Yes, that's the so we can get faster without cutting corners. We can get more efficient without being less ethical. We can do better because we have these tools now that are essentially the next generation of word processor, the next generation of calculator, that if we use them right, and it's a big if, we could do better.
Yeah. Big challenges there. I can appreciate the frustration over the logistics, because that is a big part of governing that can be quite frustrating. So I'm hopeful we're getting closer, but we'll see. When the layperson, when the average American hears AI and democracy in the same sentence, see, you chuckle, they're thinking about deep fakes. They're thinking about misinformation. They're thinking about election manipulation. So what's the risk out there that worries you the most? Is it, and is what worries you the most as somebody who's been on the inside the same as what the public is paying attention to now?
Very good question. So I'll start with perhaps the counterintuitive answer, and then I will, and then back into the story that I think you're hoping to, I will talk about, which is the negative story. But I'm going to start first with the positive. That is to say, my fear is, the greatest risk from my perspective, is that we spend so much time focused on the negative, playing defense, that we're not playing offense. In other words, so coming back to these examples of like, what can we be doing right if we are focused on saying, gee, with this tool, I could give kids a personalized reading tutor. If I'm very busily, not incorrectly, look, we're very worried about what's happening in schools, especially with social media, especially with cell phones. We're worried about the mental health issues. These are technologies, and AI included, that are privately managed and governed, owned by companies that are responsible at best to shareholders, and most of them are private and not responsible to anybody. So we have good reason to worry about the safety, security of these tools, our data, etc. But my concern is, if we're constantly talking about the robot apocalypse and the end of all jobs or the end of time, because AI will, you know, again, eat humanity, what we're missing is the question of, what can we do right here, right now? So in LA, for example, where they've said, and this is not even with, you know, generative AI, this new generation of technologies, but with traditional machine learning, they've said, we're going to take a lot of data, we're going to use AI to help us process it, and identify, a little bit like that movie, remember that movie with Tom Cruise, where they predicted who would commit a crime, Minority Report?
Yes, I remember.
This one, they are predicting who is at risk of becoming homeless. And what they do is, they pick up the phone and they call you and they say, we think you're in trouble because we can tell, we're the government. We have your income data. We have your health data. We have this data and that data. And again, it has to be done carefully and with privacy. But what they've done in LA now, and the data is showing that they have prevented 86% of the people they have reached out to from becoming homeless. So it is projects like that. It is projects happening now in California with Innovate Public Schools, which is a parent advocacy organization. I worked with them, where we have built AI tools together with families in California to help them translate, summarize, understand, and advocate for their child who receives an IEP, the Individualized Education Program, the big, ginormous PDF you get from the government when your kid has a disability. It's like a 100-page PDF of legalese, exactly that kind of problem we're talking about. AI makes it possible to translate that into Spanish, to summarize that, and to give parents who otherwise can't afford a psychologist and a lawyer and, you know, three consultants to help them advocate for their kid, to operate on a more level playing field with their school district. So my greatest concern is our failure to realize these opportunities, because we're not making the right investments. We're not focused in our legislation on what we should be doing to fix things, not just to prevent them from breaking. And we're not researching the right questions in terms of studying what actually works.
Yeah. Okay, you actually answered the next question that I had after that, which was giving a real-world example that would surprise our listeners about how you know, AI could help the government work better. And so you just gave a really good example of that. Would your answer be if you were the government's AI czar tomorrow, would that be the first thing that you would be tackling? Or if you were AI czar, is there something else that you would tackle tomorrow?
So I was AI czar. I was the first state AI czar for the state of New Jersey. I don't think they called me in New Jersey. They don't call you a czar.
No.
it's too highfalutin for Jersey. So the things that we were very focused on, I will tell you, was number one, it was education. Because you cannot understand what you can do with these tools, nor can you understand the risks, what you should not be doing. Coming back to the question about misinformation and disinformation and privacy and hallucinations, and frankly, tools that are, you know, quite good today, they do something different tomorrow. We have to learn how to use them well. So the very first thing we focused on was education, was giving access to training for free to every public servant across the whole state. And we said, look, we want you to use these tools. We also had a policy which said, don't be an idiot. Don't, you know, put your personal information in these tools and be careful about what you put on the web and don't rely on them. So we put out policy guidance, but to get access to the tools, we said you have to take a course on AI. And that course is not about a product or a vendor. It's not by Claude or ChatGPT or Gemini. That course was about how should and shouldn't I use these tools to serve the public interest. So in New Jersey, we had 16,000 people take that course. Ohio has done better. They've trained, I think, something close to 27,000 people. Similar kind of strategy of saying, like, look, it has to start with learning and yeah, then the good stuff will follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the hope.
Yeah. Because once you start using them, if you're using them wisely, it starts to change your own thinking about how you can use it better and better and better and better. And so it requires us to make some changes as well. What if the themes running through your work isn't just technology, but it's destiny? why do you think so many people feel that the future is something that happens to us rather than something that we can and should design?
I think that we have, that is a profoundly philosophical question. I do think this one is better suited to the Wine and Women talk show than the Morning Hour. That's definitely, I'd love to do that one in person in Sonoma. I think, though, that we feel very disempowered, and that has a lot to do with, just to connect this back to the, you know, there's a lot of reasons we feel disempowered in our own lives, but it has a lot to do with the promise of our democracy is unrealized. This notion that the people we elect represent and speak for us, I think most people would disagree with that. It is why rates of trust in democracy are so low. Now, partly it has to do with the fact that the population has gotten bigger and Congress has stayed the same size.
Right.
That is, the Senate has stayed the same size. And, you know, so there's just a very lot of people represented by a very, very small number of people. Yeah. But we also know that money in politics plays a huge role. We know that the people who get a seat at the table, who are sitting on the dais at the inauguration, it's not you and me. It is the big givers and the big donors. And also we see so little happening, especially out of the federal government, let alone state capitals, but definitely on the federal side, you know, there's gridlock created by partisan paralysis and partisan infighting, right? So we don't see Congress doing as much as it needs to. We see news today that a big housing bill that was agreed to on a bipartisan basis is going to be stalled, may or may not go through. The president may or may not sign it because there's another piece of legislation that he wants to put through. So we're passing less and less legislation. So it's no wonder people feel very disempowered. We also have very, very little ways to make our voices heard. And let me give a quick contrast to something that's happening locally. Just last year, 25, after the wildfires, the California Office of Data and Innovation said, we're going to go out and ask, especially Angelenos, how we could have done better, what we should do in terms of rebuilding. And they set up a website called Engage California. Nothing new in terms of like, oh, have website, let people comment. What's different this time is that because they had AI on the back end, they're able to actually sort, organize, process, summarize what people are saying. So the 1,300 comments they got in, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, they were able to very rapidly organize, sort, distill into 19 recommendations, turn those 19 recommendations into an action plan with 5 priorities, and start to implement those priorities, which included things like undergrounding power lines or streamlining permitting that people had asked for. Yeah. That's the difference. Compare that to what happens in Washington. The only way that you and I have really any voice in that process is when you vote for your member of Congress every 2 years, right, or your senator every 6 years. So I'm really excited, especially about these things happening at the state and local level. There's no reason we couldn't do it at the federal level.